Welcome to Cross Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from U.S. tax reform to the OECD's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's U.S. International Tax Services Leader. You can find me on Twitter at XBorderTax. On this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks, I'm excited to finally have Callum Dewar. Callum is an international tax partner in PwC's Washington National Tax Practice and the leader of our integrated global structuring practice, heading our outbound, inbound, and value chain transformation teams. Callum spent the first 20 plus years of his career working in the UK and has a very unique perspective on today's topic, which is BEPS 2.0. Callum, welcome to the podcast.
I'd like to say it's good to be here, but I wouldn't mean it. But I'm here.
We're excited to have you here and to get your uniquely cynical perspective on all things international taxation. So we've talked about on a number of podcasts leading up to this one, BEPS 2.0. Mm-hmm. But before we dive into BEPS 2.0, as I've been looking around, BEPS 1.0 isn't even fully implemented. We have our 15 action items. We'll talk about digital, which is action item one. But maybe can you just start with what is the landscape today on BEPS 1.0? We have the multilateral instrument. We've got ATAD 1. We're waiting for ATAD 2. But just give listeners some perspective on really what was BEPS 1.0 and where are we in the process?
So I think, you know, if you look at BEPS 1.0, there were a number of action items. Some of them were specifically transfer pricing related action items 8 through 10. And I think the OECD sort of completed their work on that with updated OECD guidelines. They may not have been fully consensus. They may not have been fully developed. But I think as far as the OECD is concerned, that work is complete. And then it's over to the relevant jurisdictions to adopt those guidelines in how they address transfer pricing. And that has been a mixed bag around the world. I mean, some people haven't really caught up with the previous OECD work on transfer pricing and the AOA and et cetera, et cetera. So not surprising there's a lag on that.
Well, and I think that that's just an important thing for the listeners to understand, first of all, is that the OECD just really provides guidance, right? I think there's 129 member countries. I can't remember the precise amount. But really, they just provide guidance and suggestions, both with respect to kind of the jurisdictional statutory law as well as recommendations to changes to the treaties.
Yeah, I mean, the OECD is actually a much smaller number than the 129. That's the inclusive framework. The OECD expanded to include a bunch of countries that are not in the OECD to get the inclusive framework to try and build consensus on international. In BEPS 1.0, there were then a number of other provisions dealing with things like hybrids, CFC rules, interest deductibility, treaty abuse. So there was a whole host of initiatives there. And the OECD produced final papers in all of those. And again, the OECD doesn't have any executive authority.
Right.
So that was then passed over to jurisdictions to do something with. And the something has varied by countries. You've got the UK and Australia who seem to be on a competition to implement everything first. And probably by everything, I mean even more than the OECD suggested in some levels. With the UK, things like diverted profits tax and the offshore royalty regimes. So, you know, those countries have gone away, taken the OECD BEPS framework and run with it. You've then got things like the rest of Europe, European Union, where the EU decided to go for a multi-jurisdictional approach and issued directives, which largely covered most of the BEPS actions, which the EU member states signed up to implement various laws by various dates. Now, some of them had to be done by 1 January 2019, interest deductibility, etc. Some had to be done by 2020, which covered things like hybrids and CFC rules. And so we're still waiting to see a number of major jurisdictions in Europe what their final legislation is going to look like with regard to some of these fairly major measures in BEPS. So they really haven't implemented yet at all. Most of the rest of the world is a long way behind that. So you look at Asia, there's not really been much activity there on hybrids and CFCs and things like that. Canada hasn't really moved significantly on it. Latin America hasn't really moved significantly on it. So there's those sort of structural changes that are still waiting to be implemented. I mean, the US obviously dealt with some of it in tax reform, but even the US, we haven't got the final regulation package on hybrids,
right,
to know exactly how the U.S.'s implementation of the hybrid provisions works.
And some of those other jurisdictions, I think like China, for example, even Canada, there's been some maybe anecdotal evidence of like one-off, like on royalty deductibility, but they have not done these wholesale systematic changes like, for example, we've seen with the U.K. and Australia.
Yeah, and then obviously there was the treaty abuse stuff. So that was interesting. That was a paper that was largely a consensus paper, with a whole bunch of provisions for treaty abuse. And then the OECD realized that having every country renegotiate all of their individual tax treaties was going to take decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came up with the multilateral instrument approach. That's been interesting. I mean, obviously, it was a novel approach to changing multiple tax treaties at the same time. But in order to do that, they ended up giving a lot of choice to countries as to which of the provisions of the treaty abuse paper would be adopted. And because of the sort of speed dating approach of the multilateral instrument, and in a lot of cases, things were only adopted if both countries who wanted their agreements to be covered adopted the same provisions. And so we've seen quite a lot of stepping back from the treaty abuse recommendations. For example, there were wholesale changes to the permanent establishment provisions proposed in the treaty abuse paper, but the vast majority of the countries that have signed up for the multilateral instrument have not adopted those changes to permanent establishment. So that those things have sort of been left on the shelf at the moment.
Most of them have adopted into limitation on benefits and this principal purpose test. We've talked about that on the podcast.
Which were required in order to be part of the MLI, to be honest. So they weren't really a choice. You had to do them.
Right.
So and even the MLI, of course, you know, hasn't largely come into effect yet. Most countries who have signed up, ratified, who've got other treaty partners who have signed up, ratified, will likely have effect from 1 January 2020. So we're still some way away from seeing the impact of the MLI from, you know, BEPS 1.0. So there's a whole host of stuff that's in BEPS 1.0 that either hasn't been implemented or is only partially implemented at the moment. So the notion that BEPS 1.0 was completed and didn't fix everything is a little surreal because it hasn't actually been implemented yet.
Well, that's what's been surprising to me, particularly being very focused on the U.S. side, and particularly 267 Cap A. And, you know, I kind of thought that the U.S. wasn't signing up for the anti-hybrid initiative or wasn't sure, right? And then obviously we got 267 Cap A, which gave great authority to Treasury to draft the rules. And I think many of us were taken aback by the breadth of some of those regulations, although the statute gave very, very broad authority to Treasury. And then to your point on the EU, I've frankly been very surprised that we haven't even seen some of these proposed rules from some of the major trading jurisdictions in Europe. And those are going to be effective January 1st, 2020. And so
if they're in compliance with the directive, they have to be.
Right. And presumably they want to try to be in compliance, although I'm still not entirely clear what happens if they're not in compliance. And that process can take some time.
You don't want to have that discussion on this podcast.
Right.
We'd be here for days.
Right. With the procedural elements of that. But so when the OECD got together, you know, within the last few months, then there's been this new, what we've been referring to as BEPS 2.0. I'm not sure if they've necessarily been referring to BEPS 2.0, but I think it really started, maybe before we dive into the BEPS 2.0, with action item one, which was really digital tax and how to tax some of these companies that are in the new economy, if you will. And there was so much focus on action items 2 through 14, as you already mentioned, from the anti-hybrid stuff, the transfer pricing, the multilateral instrument. But they're just, I don't think anybody really could figure out the digital stuff. But yet we've seen some jurisdictions take unilateral approaches, including the UK, as you mentioned. France has recently been in the news.
Yep.
But maybe before we get into BEPS 2.0, what's happened with BEPS 1.0 and the digital tax, and what's the state of the law today?
Well, so, I mean, I think, you know, action item one of the BEPS 1.0 was the digital. And the conclusion of that paper, you know, massively paraphrasing a fairly lengthy document, was we don't think we need separate rules for a digital economy because the entire economy is digitalized. Let's see if all the other action items, 2 through 15, solve the problem. And I think what's happened is politically, in certain jurisdictions, there is clearly the sense that BEPS 1.0 did not solve the problem, and the perception, whether real or otherwise, is that a number of very big name companies have emerged from BEPS 1.0 still not paying significant amount of tax in jurisdictions where they have a significant market name and presence. Mm-hmm. And you know, that politically was unacceptable in a lot of European Union jurisdictions, whether that's France or the UK. And so the EU jurisdictions, the individual jurisdictions, started pushing pretty heavily on measures that dealt with that hole. And, you know, you've seen France with the digital services tax, the UK with a similar approach. They're all focused on how do we extract some money from these companies that we think earn a huge amount of money from our market but don't pay much tax because the current international tax system doesn't force that tax. And that's either because you don't reach the level of a taxable presence in the jurisdiction, although that's fairly rare, mm-hmm. to be perfectly honest, or if you do reach the level of a taxable presence, the value being attributed to that market is not sufficient to give a big enough reward for a big enough tax base.
So compare, how did the UK address this versus France? Because I think these are interesting how these jurisdictions kind of took these on.
Well, so, I mean, the UK obviously had the first shot at it on, you know, diverted profits tax, which mm-hmm. predated BEPS. And it was rushed out before the completion of BEPS. And so that was one approach. They've now added on a digital sales tax approach proposed, being consulted on. France has just gone for a digital sales tax, which is to say, you know, if you make X number of sales or make revenues from customers, users in our jurisdiction, then you're going to pay effectively a turnover tax on that activity, which obviously is not an income tax. It's a turnover tax. That all the issues that raises has no regard to profitability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the EU have upped the pressure. And at the moment, what the EU have largely said is, well, if someone, and France, there's this notorious notional agreement of a couple of weeks ago,
right.
If the OECD can come up with an international taxing system which better taxes those activities, then we'll pull back from things like digital sales tax, etc., and we'll adopt the OECD international tax system, whatever that is. So the pressure's been put back on the OECD to try and build a consensus as to how international tax system should now work to encompass digital. But I think the thing that's happened in that process is if you take the BEPS 2.0 work paper, they've clearly gone way beyond digital.
Right.
So digital was the sort of the thing that started this, but I don't think digital is now the sole aim of the BEPS 2.0 provisions in any way at all.
So before we dive into the Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, because I definitely want to spend some time with, for maybe some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with what a permanent establishment is mm-hmm. and when something activities give rise to taxation, how would you explain to somebody, like, why isn't that income that France is trying to come after currently subject to tax in France?
Well, so, I mean, the sort of traditional permanent establishment definition largely ran off notions that were probably invented in the 30s, mm-hmm. 1930s, that is, where generally the business model was, in order to make money in a jurisdiction, you needed to have people and things in that jurisdiction. So the trigger for a permanent establishment was largely a notion of having a fixed place of business in that jurisdiction, people operating from that fixed place of business, which made all the sense in the world when you had to have an office to meet customers, you had to have a landline to phone people, you know, all of that followed from it. And then the permanent establishment definition dealt with that construct around the edges as to whether it was permanent in nature or whether it was temporary. You know, there were breaks for things like construction projects that only went on for a certain period of time. And the whole thing developed, dependent agent, all thing. But largely, the trigger point for a permanent establishment under the existing rules is some notion of a place of business. And what's happened, of course, as the business models have evolved with digitalization, internet, et cetera, is less and less do you need a permanent place.
Right.
I mean, I'm probably a working example of that. You took my office away from me years ago, and I haven't got an office.
Right.
I travel around the country seeing clients or coming into various offices, but I don't have a fixed place where I carry on business.
Right.
And, you know, that is replicated in all sorts of business models. So the notion of a fixed place of business has moved away, and the supply chain of multinationals has changed. So there's much more centralization of resources. You know, you don't have everything in each jurisdiction you operate. You may have a distribution network. You may only have a marketing entity in that jurisdiction, and there's a principal somewhere who's contracting with the third parties. And that provides some challenges from a transfer pricing and a permanent establishment perspective, given the current definitions. So I think largely what's happened is the tax definitions of permanent establishment and what constitutes a taxable presence haven't moved on with the change right. in the world. And I think there's a degree of acceptance that that is the case.
Yeah.
I don't think people are saying, to the best of my knowledge, that the permanent establishment definition that we've got that's, you know, has its genesis in the 1930s is really fit for purpose now.
Right.
The debate then turns to, well, what is fit for purpose? And having a permanent establishment doesn't necessarily solve the problem, because you've then got to determine how much profit is attributable to that activity. And that's the second part of the BEPS 2.9 work. So there's one part around, if you haven't got a taxable presence, how do we define taxable presence? The much bigger part, and much more relevant for most of our multinational clients, is not only do you have a taxable presence, because again, most companies do have a taxable presence
right.
in most jurisdictions. It's only the very sort of internet digitalized companies
right.
that really don't. The next bit then becomes, well, having defined a taxable presence, how much profit should be allocated to the market, and how much profit should be allocated to the IP or intrinsic value that's created outside of the market. And that is a big tension within BEPS 2.0.
Well, that's a perfect transition. So let's talk about, and where do you want to start? Pillar one and then pillar two, as far as the OECD's potential recommendations?
Yeah, so I'll start with pillar one. Pillar one is really focusing on the taxing rights and the calculation of how much profit should be taxed. It's very transfer pricing orientated. I'm not a transfer pricing guy, so apologies to anyone listening to this podcast if I use the wrong words. But largely what they're looking at is, A, have we got the right definition of what a taxable presence is? So there's proposals in there for a new nexus, new definition of what constitutes a permanent establishment. And that will move from a fixed place of business or a physical mm-hmm. presence to a notional presence, a digital presence, or whatever it is. So that's one element to it. And then the other bit is dealing with how do you allocate the profits. And at the moment, Pillar One has sort of three alternative approaches. One is looking at sort of a residual profit split approach. So what it's trying to do is say the group makes a whole bunch of profit. Some of that is non-routine, some of that's routine. We want to allocate the non-routine a bit more to the market jurisdictions to reflect that the market has more value.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of detail in there and a huge amount of debate as to how you do that, but that's largely one proposal.
And to that point, before we get to the other proposal, this will impact companies in any industry.
Yeah, I don't
right?
think that is in any meaningful way limited to digital. I think the nexus stuff is much more focused on the true digital, mm-hmm. saying when you've got a permanent establishment or not. Once you've gone beyond that, I think this other stuff around what the market is worth, what the distribution chain is worth, I think is, you know, relevant to multiple industries. It's not a digital provision at all. The second approach is to say, well, we'll just make it simple and we'll do a fractional apportionment. You know, you can debate how you do that, you know, what fraction, what criteria you use to define the fraction, but largely it's just saying, let's find a way to split the profits without taking out non-routine and routine, and just fractionally split the profits by some criteria. You know, that will be difficult because I think, you know, some companies may be winners on that, some companies will be losers under that until you find the right criteria for defining the fraction.
Right. And some countries could be winners, some countries could be
losers.
And
that's going to be true across all of this. So getting consensus for the OECD, and this is going to be very, very difficult because countries will be coming to this from a very different perspective, depending on what their economy is like.
And we've already seen like this happen in the tax world. Like if you think about from the state perspective,
right.
And just, you know, obviously neither of us are state and local tax experts,
right.
But we have enough experience to know that each state, right, has
yeah.
its own apportionment factors. And I mean, it's just,
yeah.
it's kind of the Wild West as far as with respect to how they're trying to allocate those taxing rights.
Yeah. And to be fair, built within the OECD proposals is very clear that there would have to be provisions put in place to avoid the occurrence of double taxation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if country X claims taxing rights, then country Y is going to have to agree to that somehow, some mutual agreement procedure. The third proposal is look at more of a distribution return and just try and define what a distribution function in that industry, in that jurisdiction should be earning, and that would be the sort of baseline of what the profit share should be. And if the current model isn't giving you that, then there'll be a change to the transfer pricing. And originally, the proposals were fairly radical in talking about moving away from traditional transfer pricing themes around things like arm's length pricing, arm's length profits. They seem to have slightly rolled back on that, as saying, well, actually, we think we can make some of these proposals consistent with that, albeit an amended view of what the ALP should be.
Mm-hmm. And ALP being arm's length pricing.
Yeah, arm's yep. So, you know, there is a bit of a move on that, but we're not really going to know until we see the next iteration of the documents as to where they're going with that.
Yeah, and one of the challenges, particularly with the U.S. tax system, is we have this concept with cost sharing and
yep.
with intellectual property and the fact that a foreign subsidiary of a U.S. multinational can mm-hmm. effectively share in the costs and is deemed to participate in those activities.
Yep.
And that isn't necessarily consistent with what we see other jurisdictions, which
right.
I think has led to some of this controversy and action items from the OECD just because of the different taxing systems.
Yeah, and I think there's a recognition, not least in the previous paper to the one we got at the moment, that maybe the approach of, you know, BEPS 1.0, which was to look at the so-called DEMPI functions, actually isn't achieving what it needs to achieve, because if the DEMPI functions aren't in the local jurisdiction, they're still not getting a return equal to the market return that they think they should be getting.
Yeah, and so maybe let's unpack that, because it's a great point. I think with BEPS 1.0, one of the ideas was, well, we should to try to honor, if you will, or respect that arm's length pricing, we should look at DEMPI, which is development, enhancement, maintenance, protection, and exploitation.
Yeah.
And the idea is, well, if you have significant people functions participating in those activities, then they should get a particular return associated
right.
with that. But then trying to actually understand a company's value chain, regardless of what their industry is and where those profit drivers are, I think has been more challenging maybe than some had thought when they put the framework together.
And especially in the context of U.S. multinationals, because the U.S. didn't really adopt the significant people function approach. The
right.
U.S. has cost sharing, which is a much more mechanical process of allocating the profitability between the US and the rest of the world, and that doesn't sit very neatly with a distribution jurisdiction trying to work out how much return it should be getting.
Right.
So it, you know, it had its challenges, there's no doubt about it.
So any thoughts or predictions as far as where we're going to be in Pillar 1? I think they said October is when they wanted to have an initial view, or the OECD wanted to have an initial view.
Well, so the timetable, I think, is still that the OECD is working to try and implement whatever is going to be implemented in 2020. They publicly stated that in order to do that, they're going to have a pretty consensus framework of the proposals by 1st of January 2020. Well, you work back from there, and there's an awful lot of work to be done from the work plan document they issued a couple of months ago to 1st of January 2020. So we're expecting another paper in the next 3 to 4 weeks, which sets out where they've got to on these various open items and what work still needs to be done. So hopefully we'll get more detail on where they are on these proposals. They clearly need to narrow down 3 choices to preferably only 1 choice.
Right.
But how to get to 1 choice with consensus by, you know, 120 plus nations is going to be very, very difficult.
Yeah, and it's fascinating just to review the timing again,
mm-hmm.
because, I mean, like when I, on the last podcast, I talked about U.S. tax reform, and then ATAD, yeah. and then this being the kind of big wave behind those mm-hmm. other two big waves that are practitioners and taxpayers are already drenched in all of this change and yeah. trying to deal with this. And ATAD 2, which is theoretically should be fully implemented January 1st, 2020. Well, the same year they want to now, you know, have BEPS 2.0, which is obviously larger than just the EU, which is ATAD.
Right.
And the timing just seems really aggressive.
Yeah, I imagine implementation would be targeted for 1 January 2021. So, implemented in 2020, but effective from 1 January 2021. But that doesn't change the fact that, you know, the potential changes they're talking about are significant. I mean, these are possibly more impactful on multinationals' tax positions than U.S. tax reform was, for example.
I agree.
And we haven't even gone into Pillar 2 yet. So, you know, huge change being written to try and keep a lot of different countries with a lot of different economic starting points
right.
happy. And the risk is that that won't happen. And there's two risks to that. One is if you don't have that action, you start getting unilateral actions, and that's clearly going to be the case. I mean, the EU have signaled that fact, that mm-hmm. they will go alone if the OECD doesn't get consensus on the digital side, at least. Or alternative, the OECD issues a paper which largely has choices in it, and then the question is going to be, well, how do you manage those choices right. to ensure there isn't double taxation? Because the OECD are very open about it. They say, you know, we don't want countries to incur double taxation. We absolutely believe there should be a way of managing that double taxation. But if you end up with different choices being exercised by different countries, it's very hard to police that double taxation.
Right. So speaking of double tax, let's move into to Pillar 2.
Right.
What is Pillar 2? And I understand the U.S. has been leading the way in this one, arguably.
Well, I'm not sure the U.S. led the way. I think the U.S. in tax reform implemented two rules, two specific rules, that have led to the debate of Pillar 2. So what Pillar 2 is, you know, largely looking at trying to prevent what they've determined is unacceptable tax base erosion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's looking at base erosion provisions, and they've really lit on two approaches with a kind of subset in there. And the two approaches is that there should be a minimum tax that is suffered by multinationals irrespective of where they're headquartered. And so that's looking at saying, well, if I've got a multinational parented out of jurisdiction X, and I look around the world and it's operating in multiple jurisdictions, and some of those profits aren't suffering a minimum tax, then there should be some form of top-up tax imposed on those low-tax profits. And that largely has its genesis in GILTI.
Right.
You know, it may have come at it from very different ways, and, you know, the various countries that are pushing for this may have said they had their own ideas first, but whatever, it really does look and feel like a version of GILTI. The challenge with it is GILTI is a construct that, when I say works very well, maybe overstating it, but at least is fits in with the U.S. tax system being a foreign tax credit system.
Right.
Whereas the rest of the world really don't have foreign tax credit systems anymore. Largely their participation exemption. When they went territorial, they really went territorial as opposed to the U.S. approach. And so, you know, taking a GILTI context and a construct and trying to make it work for various multinationals is going to be a challenge. There are design elements to it that are key. So, you know, the question as to whether you do it, look at each entity on an entity-by-entity basis. So you look at each CFC and say, is that low-taxed? Or you look at it on a jurisdictional basis and say, well, in that jurisdiction, am I low-taxed? Or do you look at it on an aggregate basis? Now, clearly the U.S. chose aggregate for the purposes of GILTI. I'm not sure that necessarily would be followed by everyone else who may be more focused on trying to make sure each dollar of low tax profit is properly taxed, and an aggregate approach doesn't necessarily achieve that. Mm-hmm. You've then got, you know, design elements around what is the appropriate minimum level of tax. And that gets into some really interesting debates, because if you're going to get consensus, you have to get the EU to play, and the EU has to operate within the fundamental freedoms established by the EU, freedom of establishment, free movement of capital, etc. So that provides its own tension into the system. And can you have a minimum tax rate which is higher than the lowest rate in the EU? Well, the lowest rate in the EU at the moment is Hungary, which is at 9%. Right. You know, if to try to impose a minimum tax of 15%, how does that sit with the EU fundamental freedoms, etc., etc.? So there's an awful lot of tension in whatever your design of guilty is. You then get the additional complexity that multinational structures are not simple for all sorts of reasons. And so you can often see situations where, taking a US multinational, for example, a US multinational will have the US on top. It may have a holding company that runs a region, or it may have a global holding company with then regional holding companies below it. Multiple jurisdictions in which you're operating. Operating companies in jurisdiction X can own operating companies in jurisdictions Y. And then you're going to have to work out, well, at what level does the minimum tax apply? If it applies from the bottom up, you hit your first holding company, you may get an imposition with a minimum tax. What happens at the next level up? Do they then say, well, because that jurisdiction taxed it, I'm okay? Or can you work down and say, well, if I'm a US multinational and everything's been within the guilty regime, no other minimum tax regime should apply? And, you know, there's attractiveness to that. It makes some sort of sense. Right. But it doesn't necessarily solve the issue that some people are trying to solve around whether all the profits have been appropriately taxed. You then get into all sorts of questions around what is the base in which I'm trying to work on what the tax is, because every jurisdiction has different tax rules. And treatment of losses, treatment of amortization, treatment of depreciation can give rise to massive timing differences between what jurisdiction X thinks the taxable profits are and what jurisdiction Y thinks the taxable profits are. And it would be unfortunate if we ended up with a regime that didn't take account of those timing differences and started imposing taxes on a per-year basis by reference to results that were going to reverse over time. So the design elements of how you deal with losses, timing differences, base differences, they're very, very complicated.
Right. And some listeners may say, well, then just eliminate the holding companies, right? And but the practical point is like, oftentimes we'll just go back to your US multinational. Maybe they go and acquire a French multinational. Yeah. Well, by definition, then that French company owns all of these other foreign subsidiaries. And even if it wasn't a quote unquote holding company, it still holds all these different subsidiaries.
Right.
And we see this throughout, you know, the whether it's foreign-based multinational, non-U.S.-based multinationals, U.S.-based multinational, these structures get built because maybe one particular jurisdiction has a bunch of cash and it invests in another jurisdiction.
Right.
And so these tiers of entities is very, very common. Frankly, even outside of, you know, in financial services and all different types of industries.
And, you know, often in the financial services area, often you're looking for a collective investment vehicle. You've got to come in through somewhere. You've got to get your collective investment through somewhere.
That's right.
So there's a whole host of reasons why intermediate holding companies exist. And the notion that they're all there for bad purposes is just not true. So then you're going to have to deal with if they're not there for bad purposes, can you take them out without a significant tax cost or other commercial implications? And that's going to be very hard to manage.
So talk about like some of the practical implication of actually trying to implement this across these jurisdictions. Is this going to be kind of the MLI 2.0? I mean, how do countries respect particularly anti-discrimination clauses and just all the various issues that we can think of from a treaty perspective?
So, that, I mean, in the working paper, there's already a recognition that treaties may have to be amended through an MLI provision to deal with this, and also the second part of Pillar 2, which is the anti-base erosion payments. And that is also recognized that treaties may well have to be amended to take account of that. And we'll be interested to see how that works. The MLI took a fair amount of time to do and really didn't actually change anywhere near as much as I think had been anticipated under the Treaty Abuse Paper. All the permanent establishment stuff that was written into the Treaty Abuse Paper and was largely consensus language. Hardly any countries have adopted that in changing their treaty under the existing MLI. So when you start getting more extreme than that, it's going to be hard for people to do. The second element of Pillar 2 is a sort of a dealing with a different approach. So rather than saying every dollar should be mopped up at the head office or the parent company level with a minimum level of taxation, this is a different approach than saying, well, I'll start at the bottom and I'll look at whether deductible payments are going out of my jurisdiction and are not being appropriately taxed somewhere. And if you take that approach, you can deny deductions, or you can look at whether the withholding taxes should be imposed or whether treaties should be denied to impose the withholding taxes. There are various measures you can look at in there. But that's looking at it from the bottom up. And clearly, which one happens first is going to be pretty important. Because you got, what you don't want is denial of deductions in jurisdiction X, and then suddenly the recipient of that is now getting those profits picked up under a minimum tax regime as well. That is double taxation.
Absolutely.
And so I think there's going to be a bit of a push-pull as to, you know, where is the starting point on the tax base that is being eroded that requires Pillar 2. Because Pillar 2 is started from the presumption there is a tax base being eroded. And so the question then becomes, whose tax base is it? And the answers to some of those questions define whether you go, you know, the anti-base erosion deductible payments provisions first, or whether you go for a minimum tax top-up first, and or some combination of both. Well, maybe, so some difficult policy issues there, more than anything else.
Huge policy issues. So, well, maybe in closing here, want to get your prediction. Now, I do want to remind listeners that I think you and I have a woeful record of potential predictions, including the U.S. presidency, including U.S. tax reform, including all 28 member states adopting ATAD. We thought none of that would happen, and it all has. So with that background, where is this heading, Callum? What's your prediction for both kind of Pillar 1, Pillar 2? What are we going to see with BEPS 2.0?
I think Pillar 1 is likely to end up with something of a meaningful consensus on some basis. I think it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with the different industries' footprints, etc. But I think there's largely an acceptance that the traditional transfer pricing and permanent establishment models need to be tweaked for the modern business world. And so I think there's some degree that's going to have to be accepted. Mm-hmm. And the honest truth is, if it's not accepted, then the players in there that are really potentially most advantaged from that are going to be most disadvantaged by things like turnover taxes, etc. So there's a degree of almost acceptance that something has to change, otherwise we're going to end up with something much worse.
Yeah.
And so where it goes, you know, which of the three options is likely to be pursued, we'll have to see. I personally believe that the sort of residual profit split method or a distribution network return is at least more explainable and more flexible to whatever industry you're in to give the right returns than just fractional apportionment, because fractional apportionment, you're either going to have to come up with a whole host of different criteria key to apportion on to cover all the different industries, or someone's going to be badly treated as compared to someone else. So that would be my guess. I don't know where my transfer pricing colleagues are on this. I'm sure they'll tell me I was a complete idiot, but that's fine. That's my guess. Pillar 2, I think, is more interesting. You know, there's aspects to Pillar 2 that could go any way. I think, you know, there's quite a push on Pillar 2. Obviously, the US, I think, is participating actively in BEPS 2.0, the US Treasury. I'm sure the US is coming at it from, well, we've got guilty and we've got beat. We've solved Pillar 2 from our perspective. Having said that, I'm not sure that necessarily the US wants the rest of the world to adopt beat in the format that the US have done and or guilty in the format that the US have done. So there's some tension there as well as to where that plays out. It's going to be much harder, I think, to get consensus on Pillar 2 not least because you've got to decide whether you are protecting the tax base of the source countries or just ensuring that multinationals pay an appropriate level of tax. And then you've got to agree what is an appropriate level of tax. And then you've got to define what falls without those parameters. And, you know, do things like FDII regimes or patent box regimes or anything like that, which are recognized incentives, some of them signed off by the OECD as not harmful tax practices, are they appropriate levels of tax? And all that debate will have to happen and play out and somehow reach consensus. And my fear is I don't know that that will happen.
Right. All within the next 15 months, potentially.
Well, I think there's a degree of leeway in that timetable because I suspect the OECD would declare victory if they got Pillar 1 implemented to avoid other unilateral actions and accept that Pillar 2 might take a little bit longer. That's my own guess. I think they would declare some level of victory at that.
I am done discounting the ambitions of the OECDs and the abilities of these multiple jurisdictions to actually implement these rules. So we'll have to leave it at that. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks. Thank you, Callum Dewar, PwC's Integrated Global Structuring Leader. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Leader. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for another exciting edition of Cross-Border Tax Talks.